from our study through some of the gospel text, which is fine. They'll still be there when we get back to them. I mentioned this morning that I had some sermons planned, and I was asked to do a series, so I said, okay, I'll do a series. So guess what I'm doing on Sunday nights? Yeah, the sermons I had planned. So never waste a sermon, right? So we're going to do a couple of weeks just to break up our study of the gospels with some material out of 1 Peter. And in particular, I'm not looking at every verse in 1 Peter. Actually, we've done that in a class not terribly long ago. I think Bill Path did the writings of Peter or something like that. So what I'm looking at is one particular theme from 1 Peter, and that is the language of pilgrimage. The language, or another word might be sojourners, people who are passing through. That description of God's people comes up again and again in 1 Peter, and I think that's an important topic given our particular moment in history, in our culture in the United States. We're a little bit behind, but you can see where Europe is already. Places that were founded on Christendom are now largely being called post-Christian. Formerly Christian nations and things like that. Lady in France, what's the new person in charge in France? Le Pen? I can't remember. She was talking about, started out talking about hijabs and burqas and things and saying, well, we don't want those worn in public, okay, so it's safety risk. And the interviewer said, well, how do you feel about yarmulkes? And she says, well, I feel the same way. How do you feel about Christian? She said, basically, there should be nothing religious in public. That was where she finally ended up. And so it started off, and you go, okay, I kind of understand the hijab thing. And then it went downhill in a hurry. Russia has a law that they've passed fairly recently against proselytizing outside of places of worship. You're welcome to talk to people about your faith in a place of worship, but you're not allowed to, or you're not supposed to be able to go out and try to convert someone to a religion of any kind outside of a building made for worship. And so, again, in the world of Europe that was largely founded on a version of Christianity, it's kind of the dim past. And in America, we're seeing much slower but very real signs of that same sort of thing. Just some studies from, I've got to turn this on, sorry. Studies from Barna Group, who do religious polling. In terms of numbers, it's not too frightening. How Americans affiliate, I hope you can read some of that, or at least see the colors. The big blue section, 73% of Americans still identify as Christians. If you ask them, what are you? They say, oh, I'm a Christian. You know, I mean, most people, that's kind of still the default answer at this point in history. An alarming 20% say they have no faith whatsoever. 6% say there's something else, and 1% say they don't know. FYI, religious is not one of those things you can not know, just for future reference. Either you are or you aren't. You can't accidentally be Catholic or something, right? I mean, that's a funny answer to me. What religion are you? I don't know. That's strange. Anyway, never mind that. 73% still identify as Christian. However, that number is thought to be pretty highly inflated, first of all. Another group of guys did a study where you didn't have to identify yourself. You just marked a number of things on a page, and that way you were kind of anonymous. And the number of people who said they were Christian went down substantially, down to 30 or 40%. So there's still some kind of pressure to feel like you should mark the Christian box if someone's asking. If someone calls you on the phone and says, what religion are you? There's still some pressure to say, well, I'm a Christian. But if you don't have to, if no one's watching, more people say, well, maybe not. But worse than that, how Americans experience and express their faith, a whopping, okay, so let's go back just a second. 73% identify as Christian, 75% say they pray to God on a regular basis. Again, that's one of those questions you ask, are you a Christian? Sure. Do you pray to God? Sure. Okay. But then when you start asking, do you do anything that a Christian would do that would make it look like you're a Christian? Those answers drop dramatically. 35%, 73% say they're a Christian. Only 35% ever go to a church. Okay, 34% ever read their Bible. 19% volunteer at any kind of nonprofit. 18% volunteer at a church. 17% attend some kind of adult Sunday school, or the other question asked was, do you attend some kind of maybe small group study? 16%. So the number, and this is the numbers that bothers the Barner people in research, so they say there's less people that identify as Christian, but the numbers they see really dropping are the ones actually participating in some kind of church activity of any kind. And so that's what, when we talk about a post-Christian culture, things that used to be a little more normal as far as behavior, what did people do on Sundays, what did they do with their time, those things are actually diminishing, while people, by and large, still kind of like to think of themselves as Christians. Another one that might be interesting to us, what kind of Christian are you, was one of the questions Barna asked. And these phrases may or may not mean anything to you, but I think they're interesting. Do you consider yourself a born-again Christian? Well, that was interesting because it just happened to be a phrase that was in the verse I'm using tonight. It's a loaded phrase, and so I understand some people, you know, I don't know. If you ask me, are you a born-again Christian, I'd probably say, define that, and then they'd probably hang up. But anyway, only 35% of the people who said they were Christian said they were some kind of born-again Christian, you know, whatever that means. The middle one surprised me. Of the people who say they're Christian, only 23% say they're Bible-minded. So Christian in a way that doesn't involve a Bible was fairly typical. What is that? It's Christian in the sense of, if you ask me, am I Christian? Oh, yeah, sure. Do you like that book Christians use? No. Right? And so that's a scary number to me. And then the smaller category of evangelical is 7%. I saw an interesting discussion today of whether or not churches of Christ would fit into evangelical. And I saw one guy who was quite convinced it would, and one guy was quite convinced it wouldn't, and both of them were sure it was obvious. And so I don't know which category. Usually evangelical means people who, the definition I've read was people who are quite certain there is no act or sacrament that contributes to salvation. So sacramental churches that practice, say, baptism and communion on a regular basis would not be evangelical. So in that case, we wouldn't be. That's a really narrow definition. So point is, I don't know what these words mean. That's what I'm getting to. And apparently, neither does anybody else, but we're not them. That's the middle one that really was surprising to me, that I assumed, are you a Bible-minded person would be as equally interesting as you say, are you a Christian? Sure. Do you read your Bible? Sure. No, people stop there. And they say, no, not really. Not interested. Not even Bible reader, are you Bible-minded? Does the Bible influence your decisions? And the answer was overwhelmingly no. So that's what we mean by a post-Christian culture, that we're not as far down the road as a lot of European countries are, but there is a definite shift in what influences people on a regular basis. Why do I go through all that? 1 Peter is a book written to the church at a time when Christianity was in a minority position, an unpopular position, facing heavy opposition. What do you tell Christians when they are the most unpopular people in town about how they live their life? That's the book of 1 Peter. And so for us, there is the possibility that we're entering a moment like that. It might be a season. It might be an age. I don't know. You know, it might be a generation and then it turns around, or it might be a downhill spiral that never stops. I'm not a prophet who can tell you the future, it turns out. You have to go to a different church for that. I don't do that here. I don't know what the future's like, sorry. But at this particular moment, there is less of a Christian influence there has been. And so we asked the question, what would it be like to be in a society where Christianity was not a majority? If those 70-some-odd percent of the people who say they were Christians but don't read their Bibles stopped saying they were Christians and stopped caring, you know, what would that do? Well, again, 1 Peter is a response to that in a sense. What do Christians do? And one thing that we talk about is you have to think of yourself as passing through. When Christianity is popular, you're tempted to say, this is where it is. This is where it's supposed to be. This is home. This is great. This is wonderful. This is the way everything should be. And we kind of forget it's not always like this. In fact, it's rarely like that. And Christian history, Christianity, as such, has quite often been a minority. And people around the world are realizing that in different ways. As I said, Europe is post-Christian. The Middle East is further along than that, right? I mean, it's violent opposition to Christianity in certain places. So the first thing, and we're going to look tonight in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 through 9. The first thing that Peter wants to talk about to people who are in a position of real powerlessness, they don't have any influence over their government, they don't have any influence over their society other than the preaching of the gospel, that which is a great power in reality, but in the perception of things doesn't seem very powerful. How do you encourage a group of people who seem like they're on the losing side of history? We even hear that phrase, don't we? Every so often in a social debate, someone will say, you Christians are on the losing side of history, right? Because what they're saying is, this is going away from Christianity. Christianity is going to be a thing of the past. You're on the losing side of history. Well, how did it feel to be a Christian in the first century? You hadn't even been around long enough to be on the losing side of history. You were a blip in history that the Roman Empire was going to exterminate like they had killed everybody else off that they didn't like. So 1 Peter chapter 1 tells them to think of this as a trial. Now think just a moment before we even get to it. Persecution, nothing like what we're enduring, to be clear. Our suffering in this present age in America is minuscule inconvenience compared to the suffering, slaughter, and death of the first century church. What word would you use to describe that? Well, suffering, slaughter, and death. Peter says, well, it's a trial. It's an assessment. That's a different way of thinking of suffering and death, isn't it? So listen, we'll look at a couple of verses. Let's start. Somebody wants to read for us 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3. Edwin, thank you.
Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead.
Okay. So point, just a couple of observations here as we move through it. A couple of things I notice. The Christian abandons hope that this fallen world will right itself. Blessed be to God, right? Blessed be God who has raised Jesus from the dead. Who raised Jesus from the dead? God does. Is this world going to fix itself? No. Who is the fixer of things that can't be fixed? That is God. And so the hope that a Christian has, so when I say abandon hope, I don't mean don't have any hope. I mean have a specific kind of hope. And the hope is in the God who raises Jesus from the dead. If you look at that carefully, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to his great mercy. If you're being persecuted, do you feel like you are you feeling God's mercy at that particular moment? Do you feel like God's being especially merciful to you? Peter says yes, because his great mercy has raised Jesus from the dead. That's where we see God's mercy. And that doesn't change. No Roman can take that away. So that is the hope. The Christian's hope begins anew at the resurrection of Jesus, and it's the resurrection that demonstrates the power of God to right any wrong, even death itself. So what are the possible outcomes if you're a Christian and persecution? Well, you could convert the entire Roman Empire and they could give up persecuting Christians. Seems unlikely, but hey, God could do it. Or they could kill you. Which one's a better solution for the Christian? Peter says, well, our God raises the dead anyway, right? His hope is not tied to any kind of civic outcome. It doesn't actually matter who's in charge in Rome or what they think about Christianity. It doesn't matter. His hope is tied to the resurrection of Christ. Now, in Jesus, we have a perfect example of this. The government, the people in power, killed Jesus. Did they win? No. Jesus is risen from the dead. So what's the message to suffering Christians? If the powers of this world were to take it all the way to the extreme and kill you, thank God that we have this mercy that he has raised Jesus from the dead. That's just the introductory thought. Look in verse 4 as it expands on this a little bit. Somebody want to read verse 4 to us. Denny, thank you. Thank you. So the resurrection is not just a resurrection, actually. That would be fine enough. But I suppose you could have a bad resurrection. How about Lazarus? Lazarus is raised from the dead. You know what happens to Lazarus? Eventually he dies again, right? Would it be any good if God raised us from the dead after our suffering as Christians just so people could arrest us and kill us for being Christians? And every week we just redid it over and over again. Sunday morning, everybody comes back to life and they kill us all over. I don't know if that's what we're signing up for, is it? Right? So Peter says, no, it's not just a resurrection, which is impressive enough. It is a resurrection to something glorious. That God is going to not only right the ship, he's going to make something better for you. The Christian's hope is of an inheritance, which is an interesting word in this, because in the way of the thinking of the persecutors, they were taking everything away from the Christians. You have nothing. Quite literally, they were naked, destitute, homeless, jobless, and being killed. Peter says, yes, but there's an inheritance. What kind of an inheritance? The kind nobody can take. So he uses four descriptions here. Imperishable. It cannot be taken or destroyed. One of the quickest and easiest forms of persecution of the early church was economic. They took people's property. They took people's land. They cut them off from business. If you weren't part of the imperial cult, you couldn't do business with imperial people. You were taxed different. There were just all sorts of ways economically that they could take away what you had. God says your inheritance is imperishable. No one is able to conquer it, to take it. It has no expiration date. Undefiled. It is not tainted by evil. Even the victories we have in this world are bittersweet, aren't they? Because this world still has evil in it. The inheritance we're promised is undefiled. It's not a bittersweet joy. It is a perfect joy. It is an undefiled promise that nothing can taint. What if I have to die and suffer to get there? Even that does not taint or defile the inheritance that we're promised. Unfading. It does not grow dim with the passage of time. So we have seasons in life. Things get a little better. Things get a little worse. Things get a little better. Things get a little worse. This is the same way it is with persecution in the early church. An emperor would get it in his head, it's time to persecute Christians, and they would. And then they'd get bored with it, and they'd move on to somebody else, and they'd leave Christians alone for a little while, and they'd come back and persecute them again. And then they'd leave them alone, and they'd persecute them again. So every time they won a small victory, oh, leave the Christians alone. They didn't last, right? Even small victories seem to fade and lose their appeal. The promise of ultimate victory, of the resurrection and the life to come, is unfading. What's the line in the song we sing? When we've been there 10,000 years, we've only just begun, right? We've no less days to sing God's praise. All those lines we sing about the life to come, they are descriptive of this unfading, that it's a complete victory that is never diminished, never has to be fought again and conquered again. It's victory. And then finally, kept in heaven, where the poll results are decidedly better. Right? There is no post-Christian heaven. There is no post-God heaven. There is no possibility that something here on earth alters the politics of heaven. They're untouchable. The same person who is in charge is still in charge and has made these promises. So listen to how he describes, in a time of persecution, he says, this is the inheritance we have, and it's simply untouchable. And he has to say it like that because all of these things describe them right now. Right? They are perishing, they are being defiled, they are fading away because here on earth they're being killed. He says what is promised to you is the opposite of every one of those things. Persecution can't touch this. One more verse and we'll stop for some discussion. Someone want to read verse 5 for us? Yes, Todd. And then this is the critical move. God has not forgotten you. How do you feel when you're being persecuted? You feel very forgotten. He says God has not forgotten his people. He continues to care and guard you. Again, is that what you feel like when you're being persecuted? The only people guarding you are the people who are fixing to throw you to the lions. Peter says he is still guarding your salvation. You are being fed to the lions. Your hope is not. God is guarding that. Salvation will still be revealed at the end. What does that mean? Why does he emphasize it will be revealed at the end? Because it hasn't been revealed yet. That lets them know we aren't there yet. And in this life, we have many sorrows, right? In this moment in Christian history in the first century, it is bitter and ugly. The promise is, don't be disheartened because things are bad now. The victory will be revealed at the coming of Christ, not at this moment. So the point I'm really trying to emphasize here is he's just trying to help them work through emotionally and intellectually about what they're going through and how to think about it as Christians. Discussion points. How does the resurrection of Jesus still give us hope in our post-Christian world? If the Christian dominance, I use that word, I don't really like that word, the Christian popularity or whatever of American Christian influence in American culture is perishing, defiled, and fading, what does that mean? And in what sense then is God guarding us by faith, as verse 5 mentions? Well, what in those passages, I'm talking about first century world where they're dying, what lessons from what Peter's telling them translate into this moment where we feel like the culture is turning, nothing's gotten violent for us yet, and we're very grateful for that. But what lessons do we learn about how to live a life where Christianity is no longer the influential, popular option for a lot of people? Jim, go ahead.
Well, it's awfully difficult not to fall prey to Psalms 137 for us as Christians to see our culture being destroyed by a non-Christian element, which your point is well made. We are fading. We are in demise in America. And it's disgusting to me to see that, having seen the other side of it.
No, but it was culturally normal, right? I mean, you met a person, and you just assumed they probably went to church somewhere.
And yeah. It no longer carries that stature, if you will.
Yeah.
And it's awfully difficult. I fight with myself personally. I fight with everybody else not to wish some bad luck on some
So what I got out of what you were saying that I thought was really interesting was, and all of it was interesting, but one point that was that you pointed to Psalm 137 and you said, you know, there's that temptation. What do you feel like when things are going badly? You have two options. One is Psalm 137, to focus on God, get them. You know, I want some bolts of lightning. I want some death and dismemberment of the people that are hurting something I care about. The other option is what Peter is advancing. Turn from that and focus instead on what cannot be taken from you, that hope that is imperishable. Does that make sense? That's what he's calling them to do. He doesn't say the other, but I think that's the point. Don't focus on the things that are fading. That's a pretty miserable way to focus. He's not saying it's not true. He's just saying, let's not look at that. Let's emphasize what is unfading. Let's emphasize the hope that no one can touch, because that's what's going to get Christians through a difficult era in the first century. Any other quick comments? And then I had a couple other verses I want to cover. David? And then,
it reminds the same language is used in the book of Revelation.
I thought you were going to say that, since you're teaching Revelation, yeah.
Especially chapter 12, the victory in Jesus.
Yep.
And we focus sometimes on the pain and suffering here and lose sight of the fact that this is a little, just a vapor
yeah.
of time compared to eternity. You know, verse 10 of chapter 12 says, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of His Christ have come.
Yeah.
And so, again, it's keeping your eyes on the Christ. It's keeping our focus off of the things of the world.
When you're going through it, it seems all important. And God often asks us to back up a step and look at it differently. To look at it in terms of an unfading inheritance. Look at it in terms of ultimate victory. And that's hard to do. Afterwards, it's easy. Oh, why were you guys worried? But when you're going through it, it's difficult. And let me just, again, emphasize the point Jim was making. We're only going through, like, a tiny taste of actual disposition and suffering. And think about how disheartening that can be. Now think about violence to family members and things of that. And think about the despondency you would have and how hard it is to do what David's pointing out in Revelation, to look at it and say, God is still going to win. God has already won. It just has not been revealed this particular season of life. That's hard to do. But it is what the Bible asks of people who are going through moments of despair, to step back and look at a bigger picture. And that is hard.
And the biggest thing that you're asked to do in the book of Revelation is to remain faithful unto death.
Yep.
Because once you die as a faithful witness, Satan no longer can touch you.
Yeah.
That's where his power ends.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the whole message that I'm getting out of that chapter 11 and 12 there in Revelation.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's the point out of these verses, is that there is an inheritance that evil cannot touch, cannot even defile. There's nothing in this life that evil can't taint. It makes even the best things bad, and it seems like you just can't get ahead of it. There is an inheritance that can't be defiled. Yeah, that's good. Let me move ahead, because the title of the sermon was trials, and I haven't got to the verse about trials, so let me just say a little bit. Somebody want to read verse 6 for us quickly. Chapter 1, verse 6. James, thank you.
In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials.
So, a couple of points. First of all, that hope you have focused on in verses 3 through 5 is supposed to produce joy. How can we possibly have joy when everything's going bad? He acknowledges, right now, you are grieved. For a little while. What was a little while? Like the entire first century. I mean, it was the entire lifetime. There are people who lived and died in Christian persecution, and that was all they ever knew. So that's what David's pointing out, that it's so difficult to take a step back and think about the bigger picture. Now we look back and say, you know, Christian persecution, that's a thing of the past for us. I mean, we've never, ever experienced something like that. But for them, it was their entire lives. How does Peter say to think about it? Now, for a little while, you are grieved. So you're going to have to look for joy in the hope that you're waiting for. You're going to have to step back and think about that differently. And what are you grieved by? He calls it various trials. What's a trial? Well, what is the purpose of a trial? If you go to court, what's the purpose of it? Establish guilt or... or innocence, to find truth, right? We're assessing something. We have a question, and we need an answer. And this is going to give us an answer. And he uses that word and says, this, don't think of it as suffering. Think of it as a trial. This is going to show us what Christianity is all about. This is a trial. And he keeps using that language. Look in the next verse. Let me read verse 7 for sake of time. So that the tested... hear that? See, trial in verse 6. Now, the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So you think about the production of fine jewels and gems and metals and fine metals. There's a process, and it's a painful process, to work the impurities out of even something valuable. The result is something that lasts, that is beautiful to behold, that is worth the effort. But if you ask a block of gold while it was being smelted, while it was being put in the furnace and tested, it would say, this is a terrible idea, don't do this. But the end result is that you have tested it and found what it really is, a precious thing. So Peter uses that analogy, and it's a painful analogy. Don't miss the point. Tested by fire, they were burning Christians. That's not just a cute metaphor. They were burning Christians. And he says, that fire is a test. That fire, not a test in the sense that I'm just testing you to be a pest. It is refining. It is an assessment that refines and makes better a genuine faith that can endure. Boy, that is such a hard message if you're the one being set on fire. Again, it's easy for me 2,000 years later to say, yeah, you Christians, just stick, hang in there and it'll be fine. It is so difficult, but Peter, with a lot of guts, says this is the message you're going to need in this moment in time. You need to think of this as a test. Not in the sense, again, that God is just testing you to have fun. That's not the point. But this is an incident in life that is refining and will result in demonstrating what you are. It's not pleasant in any way. Genuine faith is the result, and it has great value. Though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. This test checks your relationship to Jesus. Okay? Think about this now. These people that Peter is writing to are in a period of Christian history where they suffered for the entire period of their Christian lives. But they're far enough away from the gospel events. These people had never met Jesus. So for a man that they had never met, based on events in his life that Peter says had happened, they are dying. He says, that is a faith that's going to be worth something if you can hang on to that. It will fill you with inexpressible joy. Well, it'd have to be inexpressible, wouldn't it? Because how do you explain where I'm going to find joy in all this? But he says, this is going to make it worthwhile. Look at the test. He says, you have not seen him, yet you love him. When you're suffering, it's probably not an intellectual proposition that keeps you faithful. It is your love for Jesus. Either you love him or you don't. And when you're suffering, it is that relational connection to Jesus that's either going to keep you through or not. Do you believe in him? I mean, are you actually ready to die, believe in him, convinced? Do you rejoice in him? Because ultimately, humans are only made to be miserable for so long before we all give up. You got to find some joy, even in misery, or we're going to give up. And God knows that about us. He made us that way. So if you can't find some joy in Christian faith, even in hardship, eventually it's going to wear you down. Can you rejoice in the opportunity that you've been given in Christ Jesus? Do you seek his glory even when all of yours is taken away? That's the test that we're passing when things are difficult. The early church fathers outside of the New Testament wrote things that sound like this. Christianity is at its best when it's hated by the world. Ignatius is on his way to be put to death, and he wrote, "At last I am becoming a disciple." I mean, they thought of it as a rare privilege to actually get to experience this as Jesus did. And they just had to, we read it and think, these guys were off the rockers. They are crazy. But what it had done, they believed, and their connection to Christ through faith and love was so real that it actually changed the way they viewed pain and the suffering of this life and allowed them to endure. Last verse, and I know I'm out of time. Verse 9, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. The result of a faith that passes that test is the praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Christ and the salvation of the soul. It is something worthwhile, and it's for that joy that we hope and look forward to. So in our moment in history, I tell this story not to make you feel like, oh, we're being persecuted, it's terrible, because we have nothing on the first century Christians. But when you have a moment of despair and you feel like a way of life is passing or things are changing, these are the lessons that people in a much worse situation learned about how to deal with that moment in history. And we'll get some more of it next week. Thanks for your attention and comments.